You'll like him, using his baby talk nickname, when you know him. I like them both, truly. Then you have the rich, and nothing is ever as it was again. The pilot fish leaves, of course. He is always going somewhere or coming from somewhere, and he is never around for very long. He enters and leaves politics or the theater in the same way he enters and leaves countries and people's lives in his early days. He is never caught, and he is not caught by the rich. Nothing ever catches him, and it is only those who trust him who are caught and killed. He has the irreplaceable early training of the bastard, and a latent and long-denied love of money. He ends up rich himself, having moved $1's width to the right with every dollar that he made. These rich loved and trusted him because he was shy, comic, elusive, already in production. And because he was an unerring pilot fish, they could tell that through all the then true sincerity of his politics, it was a passing sham, and that he was one of them, although he did not know it then. When you have two people who love each other, are happy and gay, and really good work is being done by one or both of them, people are drawn to them as surely as migrating birds are drawn at night to a powerful beacon. If the two people were as experienced or as solidly constructed as the beacon, there would be little damage except to the birds. The people who attract people by their happiness and their performance are usually inexperienced, but they learn quite rapidly how not to be overrun, and they learn how to go away. But they have not learned about the good, the attractive, the charming, the soon beloved, the generous, the understanding rich, who have no bad qualities and who give each day the quality of a festival, and who, when they have passed and taken the nourishment they needed, leave everything deader than the roots of any grass Attila's horse's hooves have ever scoured. That year the rich came led by the pilot fish. A year before, they would never have come. There was no certainty then. The work was as good and the happiness was greater, but no novel had been written, so they could not be sure. They never wasted their time nor their charm on something that was not sure. Why should they? Picasso was sure, and of course had been before they had ever heard of painting. They were very sure of another painter, many others, but this was the one they had taken up. He was a good enough painter, too, if you liked it, and no one's fool. But this year they were sure, and they had the word from the pilot fish who turned up, too, so we would not feel that they were outlanders and that I would not be difficult. The pilot fish was our friend, of course. It gives me the horrors now to remember it. In those days, I trusted the pilot fish as I would trust, in those days, the corrected hydrographic sailing directions for the Mediterranean, say, or the tables in Brown's Nautical Almanac. Under the charm of these rich, I was as trusting and as stupid as a bird dog who wants to go out with any man with a gun, or a trained pig in a circus, who has finally found someone who loves and appreciates him for himself alone. That every day should be a fiesta seemed to me a wonderful discovery. I even read aloud the part of the novel that I had rewritten, which is about as low as a writer can get, and much more dangerous for him as a writer than glacier skiing unroped before the full winter snowfall has set over the crevices. When they said, "It's great, Ernest. Truly, it's great. You cannot know the thing it has," I wagged my tail in pleasure and plunged into the everyday a fiesta concept of life to see if I could not bring some fine, attractive stick back instead of thinking, if these bastards like it, what is wrong with it? That was what I would think if I had been functioning as a professional, although, if I had been functioning as a professional, I would never have read it to them. That was a horror winter. Before these rich had come, we had already been infiltrated by another rich, using the oldest trick probably that there is. This is when an unmarried young woman becomes the temporary best friend of another young woman who is married, comes to live with a husband and wife, and then unknowingly innocently and unrelentingly sets out to marry the husband. When the husband is a writer and doing difficult work on a book, so that he is occupied much of the time and is not a good companion or partner to his wife for a big part of the day, the arrangement has advantages until you know how it works out. The husband has two attractive girls around when he has finished work. One is new and strange, and if he has had bad luck, he gets to love them both. Then the one who is relentless wins. It sounds very silly, but to really love two women at the same time, truly love them, is the most destructive and terrible thing that can happen to a man when the unmarried one decides to marry. The wife does not know about it and trusts the husband. They have been through really difficult times and share those times and have loved each other, and she finally trusts the husband truly and completely. The new one says you cannot really love her if you love your wife too. She does not say that at the start. That comes later when the murder is done. That comes when you lie to everyone all around and all you know is that you truly love two women. There is all that time when you do things that are impossible, and when you are with one you love her, and with the other you love her, and together you love them both. You break all promises, and you do everything you knew that you could never do nor would want to do. The one who is relentless wins. But finally, it is the one who loses that wins, and that is the luckiest thing that ever happened for me. So that was the sort of winter the last one was. These are the things I remember about it. They have shared in everything. They are never bored together, and they have something that is unbreakable. They love their child, and they love Paris, Spain, parts of Switzerland, the Dolomites, and the Vorarlberg. They love their work, and she has sacrificed hers to his, and never mentioned it. Then, instead of the two of them and their child, there are three of them. First, it is wonderful and fun, and it goes on that way for a while. All things, to be truly wicked, must start from an innocence. So you live day by day and enjoy what you have and do not worry. You love both, and you lie and hate it, and it destroys you, and every day is more dangerous, and you work harder. And when you come out from your work, you know what is happening is impossible, but you live day to day as in a war. Everyone is still happy, except you, when you wake in the middle of the night. You love them both now, and you are gone. Everything is split inside of you, and you love two people now instead of one. When you are with the one, you love her and the one who is away. When you are with the other, you love her and the other who is away. When you are with them both, you love them both, and the strange part is that you are happy. But as it goes on, the new one is not happy then, because she can see you love them both, although she is still settling for that. When you are alone with her, she knows you love her, and she believes that if someone loves someone, they cannot love anyone else. And you never speak about the other to help her and to help yourself, although you are past help. You never know, and maybe she did not know when she made her decision, but sometime in the middle of the winter, she began to move steadily and relentlessly toward marriage, never breaking her friendship with your wife, never losing any advantage of position, always preserving an appearance of complete innocence, going away elaborately, but only being away at any time long enough so that you would miss her too badly. The winter of the avalanches was like a happy day in childhood compared to this last winter. The new and strange girl that now owned half of you, once she had decided to marry, you could not say decided to break up the marriage, because that was only a necessary step, a regrettable step, not an end, probably passed over or avoided in thinking, made only one grave mistake. She undervalued the power of remorse. It was necessary that I leave Schrunz and go to New York to straighten out who I was publishing with after the first book of stories. It was a bitter winter on the North Atlantic, and there was snow knee-deep in New York. And when I got back to Paris, I should have caught the first train from the Gare de l'Est that would take me down to Austria. But the girl I was in love with was in Paris now, still writing to my wife. And where we went and what we did, and the unbelievable wrenching, kicking happiness, selfishness, and treachery of everything we did, gave me such happiness, an unkillable, dreadful happiness, so that the black remorse came, and hatred of the sin, and no contrition, only a terrible remorse. When I saw my wife again standing by the tracks as the train came in by the piled logs at the station, I wished I had died before I ever loved anyone but her. She was smiling, the sun on her lovely face tanned by the snow and sun, beautifully built, her hair red gold in the sun, grown out all winter awkwardly and beautifully, and Mr. Bumby standing with her, blonde and chunky, and with winter cheeks looking like a good Vorarlberg boy. "Oh, Tati," she said, when I was holding her in my arms, "you're back, and you made such a wonderful, successful trip. I love you, and we've missed you so." I loved her, and I loved no one else, and we had a lovely magic time while we were alone. I worked well, and we made great trips, and it wasn't until we were out of the mountains in late spring and back in Paris that the other thing started again. Remorse was a fine, good thing, and with a little luck, and if I'd been a better man, it might have saved me for something worse, probably, instead of being my true and constant companion for the next 3 years. Maybe the rich were fine and good, and the pilot fish was a friend. Certainly the rich never did anything for their own ends. They collected people then, as some collect pictures and others breed horses. And they only backed me in every ruthless and evil decision that I made, and all of the decisions seemed so inevitable and logical and fine, and all had been brought about by deceit. It wasn't that the decisions were wrong, although they all turned out badly finally from the same fault of character that made them. If you deceive and lie with one person against another, you will eventually do it again. If some person is able to do it to you once, another person will do it again. I had hated these rich because they had backed me and encouraged me when I was doing wrong. But how could they know it was wrong and had to turn out badly when they had never known all the circumstances? It was not their fault. It was only their fault for coming into other people's lives. They were bad luck for people, but they were worse luck to themselves. And they lived to have all of their bad luck finally to the very worst end that all bad lucks could go. For the girl to deceive her friend was a terrible thing, but it was my fault and blindness that this did not repel me. Having become involved in it and being in love, I accepted all the blame for it myself and lived with a remorse. The remorse was never away day or night, until my wife had married a much finer man than I ever was or ever could be, and I knew that she was happy. But that winter, before I knew that I would ever get back into the badness, we had a lovely time at Schrunz, and I remember all of it, and the coming of that spring in the mountains, and how much my wife and I loved and trusted each other truly, and how happy we were that all the rich were gone, and how I thought we were invulnerable again. But we were not invulnerable, and that was the end of the first part of Paris. And Paris was never to be the same again, although it was always Paris, and you changed as it changed. We never went back to the Vorarlberg, and neither did the rich. I do not think even the pilot fish ever went back. He had new places to pilot the rich to, and finally he became a rich himself. But he had his bad luck first, and it was worse than anyone's. Nobody climbs on skis now, and almost everybody breaks their legs. But maybe it is easier in the end to break your legs than to break your heart. although they say that everything breaks now, and that sometimes, afterwards, many are stronger at the broken places. I do not know about that now, but this is how Paris was in the early days, when we were very poor and very happy. Nada e pues nada. This will give you some account of the people and the places when Hadley and I believed we were invulnerable. But we were not invulnerable, and that was the end of the first part of Paris, all right. Nobody ever climbs on sealskins now. They do not have to. There have been different bindings, good and bad, and maybe in the end it is easier to break your legs than to break your heart, although they say whatever breaks, that many are stronger at the broken places. I do not know about that now, today, on this morning, but I know who said it, and I back it. They ski much better now, are better taught, and the good ones do it beautifully. They come down faster and they drop like birds, strange birds that know many secrets. And it is only the new deep snow that makes the extra danger for those who need the packed tracks. They all know many secrets now, as we knew other secrets when we ran the glaciers unroped and there were no ski patrols. They are better skiers than we ever were, and they would have done the high mountains too if there had been no lifts, and that was what they had to do. A different problem has been set. If they start early enough and have the new secrets and the talent, nothing may break, even in racing, the way it went this year at Sun Valley, and no one should ever be killed as things are organized everywhere. They even fire cannon now and use mortars to start the avalanches. No one can ever say they will not break a leg now under certain conditions. Breaking a heart is different. Some people say there is no such thing. Certainly you cannot break it if you do not have it, and many things unite to take it away from those who started with it. Perhaps there is nothing there. Nada. You can take this or not. And it can be true or not. There are philosophers who explain it very well. In writing, there are many secrets, too. Nothing is ever lost, no matter how it seems at the time, and what is left out will always show and make the strength of what is left in. Some say that in writing you can never possess anything until you have given it away, or, if you are in a hurry, you may have to throw it away. In much later times than these stories of Paris, you may not have it ever until you state it in fiction. And then you may have to throw it away, or it will be stolen again. They say other things too, but do not pay them too much attention. They are the secrets that we have, that are made by alchemy, and much is written about them by people who do not know the secrets, or the alchemy. There are many more explainers now than there are good writers. You need much luck, in addition to all other things, and you do not always have it. This is regrettable, but nothing to complain about, as you should not complain of those explainers who tell you how you do it and why, if you do not agree with them. Let them explain it all, but it must be difficult to reconcile the nothingness you know and the part where you live in other people. Some wish you luck, and others do not. Good writing does not destroy easily, but you must be careful making jokes. Then you remember Evan, the last time in Cuba when he came over with the pancreas cancer still draining. He was dressing it himself and covering the horses at the Gulfstream Park for the Morning Telegraph. He was ahead on his work and he flew over. He had not brought the morphine he needed nor a prescription because they said it was so easy to get in Cuba, and it wasn't. There had been a crackdown. He had come to say goodbye, but naturally he would not say it. You could smell the discharge from the cancer draining. "The doctor will certainly bring it," he said. "There's something holding him up. I'm so sorry about the pain, him, and being a nuisance. He should be here by now. Let's remember all the funny parts about the old days and the great people. Remember Desnos? That was a wonderful book he sent you. Remember the time you turned up in Madrid from the hospital at Murcia and Alpargatas in the snow when you were on convalescent leave, after you'd been wounded and you slept under the covers across the foot of the bed, And John Sinakis slept on the floor, and John cooked for us? Good, John. Remember the wolf when he was a herd boy? I was self-conscious about coughing so much. It never means a thing when I cough blood, but it's embarrassing. You know Paris was a happy time, and Key West was quite wonderful too, but Spain was much the best. And the other war. How did you ever get in, really? They'll always take you if you really want to go. I took it very seriously, and I made Master Sergeant. It was so easy after Spain. It was rather like being back in school and quite a lot like being with the horses. Combat was interesting as a problem. I have all the poems stashed away. The pain was very bad now, and we had remembered so many truly funny things and great people. You were very thoughtful about them, Hem. It is not that things should be published, but I believe now that it is important that they exist. We've both existed quite a lot, haven't we, Hem? And you wrote awfully well about nada. Nada e pues nada, I said. But I remembered the Gulf Stream and the sea and other things. You don't mind if I'm serious, Hem. It's been so good to talk about Monsieur Dunning and Le Fou dans le Cabanon on that wonderful voyage on the old Paris, and the disappearance of Mr. Vosper and André and Jean, the two of them, the waiters. And André Masson and Johan Miro and what happened to them. Remember when you had me on the allowance from the bank and the paintings I bought then? But you must keep on, because you write for all of us. Who's all of us? Please don't be difficult. I mean us of the early days, and the best parts, and the bad parts, and Spain. Then this other one, and everything since, and the times now. You have to put in the fun and the other that only we knew, who have been at some strange places in some strange times. Please do it, even when you want to never think about it. And you have to put it in now. I am so busy with the horses that I don't know about now. Only my now. I'm sorry he's late with that stuff, Evan. That stuff is our now for today. It's only pain, he said. There must be some good reason for the delay. We'll go in and find some. Isn't it operable, Evan? No. It's been operated, of course. Should we not talk about our bodies? I'm so happy your tests are negative. That's wonderful, Hem. You'll forgive me speaking so seriously about your writing. I'm asking you to do the opposite of what I've done about my poetry. You understand why. We never had to make explanations to each other. I write about my now. It is the horses. You have a very interesting now, and you've made me presence of many places and people. Let's go in and find some, Evan. I had a whole bit left from the boat, but I did not like to leave it around the place, so I burned it probably. We might miss him on the way. I'll call another doctor. There's no sense waiting longer when it is unbearable. Please don't bother. I should have brought it myself. I'm sure he will be coming. I'll just go over to the little house a moment, if you don't mind, and lie down. Hem, you won't forget about the writing?
No, I said. I won't forget about the writing.
I went out to the telephone. No, I thought. I would not forget about the writing. That was what I was born to do and had done and would do again. Anything they said about them, the novels or the stories or about who wrote them, was all right by me. But there are remises or storage places where you may leave or store certain things such as a locker trunk or duffel bag containing personal effects or the unpublished poems of Evan Shipman, or marked maps or even weapons there was no time to turn over to the proper authorities. And this book contains material from the remise of my memory and of my heart, even if the one has been tampered with and the other does not exist. Fragments. The following fragments are transcriptions of handwritten drafts of false starts for the introduction. They are gathered in item 122 in the Hemingway collection at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. This book is fiction.
I have left out much and changed and eliminated, and I hope Hadley understands. She will see why I hope. She is the heroine and the only person who had a life that turned out well, and as it should, except certain of the rich. This book is fiction. I have left out much and changed and eliminated, and I hope Hadley understands. A book of fiction may eliminate and distort, but it tries to give a fictional picture of a time and the people in it. No one can write true fact in reminiscences. Evan would back you up, but he is dead. Scott would disagree. Miss Moorhead would sue if you published anything against Walsh, and she had many letters and much basis to sue on. The story about Walsh will have to come out. This book is all fiction, and the fiction may throw some light on what has been written as fact. Hadley is the heroine, and I hope she will understand and forgive me writing fiction. Some others never will. It is hopeless not to expect to be sued by people all of whose names begin with Miss. This book is fiction, but there is always a chance that such a work of fiction may throw light on what has been written as fact. There is much about poverty, but it was not all poverty. Hadley would know and understand why certain things were altered, I hope, and why it was fiction. She would understand why fiction is fiction, and when it is fact. Other people will not understand why they are included or not included. Everyone sees it differently, and nearly 40 years are gone. Characters that seem strongest and most important to themselves are not there afterwards, although, to themselves, they are always more there than anyone. Most of the voyages are not there, nor many people that we loved and cared for deeply. It has been cut ruthlessly, as fiction should be. The worst part of it is that you cannot publish it after you are dead, because people will still sue, even though you change the names and call it fiction as it is. Hadley would not sue because she is the heroine, and would understand when you wrote fiction with her in it. This book is fiction, but there is always a chance that such a work of fiction may throw some light on what has been written as fact. It was necessary to write as fiction rather than as fact, and Hadley would understand, I hope, why it was necessary to use certain materials or fiction rightly or wrongly. All remembrance of things past is fiction, and this fiction has been cut ruthlessly, and people cut away, just as most of the voyages are gone along with people that we cared for deeply. Only they know certain things. Other people are not there, as people are not there in life afterwards, although, to themselves, they are always more there than anyone. There is no last chapter. There were 50. I hope some people will understand and forgive the fiction and why it was made that way. It has been cut ruthlessly and many things changed. Many voyages have been omitted along with many people. There is no catalog of omissions or subtractions. The lesson that it teaches has been omitted. You may insert your own lesson and the tragedies, generosities, devotions, and follies of those you knew. Unscramble them as in an instrument of transmission and insert your own. You will be wrong, of course, as I was. Two things are important. Nothing lasted with us, no matter how well intended, and they ski much better now than they did in our time. Nobody has to climb on seal skins anymore unless they want to, but they are beautifully instructed now and are better in everything. People break their legs, and in the world some people still break their hearts. They come down faster and they drop like birds that know many secrets. They have no time to tell their secrets as they pass. Everyone knows many secrets now, and everyone has written everything and will write more. It would be fine if it could all be true, but lacking that, I have attempted in this fiction only to make it interesting. Nobody was invulnerable, but we thought we were then. And hearing someone's voice over the telephone, you know they still are, and that they deserve it. This book is fiction, and many things have been changed, in fact, to try to make it a picture of a true time. There is no formula to explain why this book is fiction, nor will it be effective. It seemed so easy when it started, then you found mistakes and errors. This book is fiction and should be read as such. It may throw some light on other books that have been written as fact. I apologize to Hadley for any misrepresentations or mistakes or for any errors. She is the heroine of the stories, and I hope she understands. She deserves everything good in life, including accurate reporting. This book is fiction, but there is always a chance that such a work of fiction may throw some light on what has been written as fact. Hadley would understand why it could be necessary to write as fiction rather than as fact, and she would see what I have used as the materials for fiction rightly or wrongly. Scott has his own fiction, and I wrote about his complicated tragedies, his generosities, and his devotions, and left them out. Others have written of him, and I have tried to help them out. Almost everyone is out, along with most of the voyages, the people that we knew and loved, and the things they and they alone knew. Only a part of the Paris that we knew is in this book, and I will not catalog what is missing. It is not easy to put in the missing all in fiction, and it is all in if you leave it out. They ski much better now, and some break their legs and some break their hearts. The latter is important and unfortunate, and some good philosophers explain how you cannot break them if they were not there, and something happened and they did not exist. The important thing is that they should ski better, and they do. They also write better, and everything, including several wars and all that comes between, helped on that along with every good writer from the start. Remembrance of things past was fiction, too. The following fragment may have been intended as a revision for The Education of Mr. Bumby. It is item 186 in the Hemingway collection at the John F. Kennedy Library, Boston. In those days, it was no disgrace to be crazy, but on the other hand, you got no credit for it. We, who had been at the war, admired the war crazies, since we knew they had been made so by something that was unbearable. It was unbearable to them because they were made of a finer or more fragile metal, or because they were simple and understood too clearly. The following two fragments were crossed out of the handwritten draft of Secret Pleasures. We had been armored together by two things. The first was the loss of everything I had written over a period of 4 years, except for two stories and a few poems. I was working at the Lausanne Conference for the Toronto Star and two news services, the International and Universal. Before Christmas, I had arranged for someone to fill in for me for the news services and had written Hadley to come down so we could go skiing together over the holidays. It had been an interesting conference, and I had been working very hard, running a 24-hour service for the two agencies under two different bylines, my own and an imaginary character named John Hadley, who was supposed to be a middle-aged and unimpeachable authority on European politics. My last dispatch would be filed sometime before 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would leave a wire opener for the morning with the concierge at the desk when I went up to bed. The morning Hadley's train was to get in, I went down to go to the station to meet her, and the concierge gave me a cable. She was coming on a later train. When we lived in Austria in the winter, we would cut each other's hair and let it grow to the same length. One was dark, and the other dark red gold. And in the dark, in the night, one would wake the other swinging the heavy dark or the heavy silken red gold across the other's lips in the cold dark in the warmth of the bed. You could see your breath if there was moonlight. The following fragments are transcribed from handwritten drafts for the ending of the book. They are item 124 in the Hemingway collection at the John F. Kennedy Library, Boston. There was much more to write about poor Scott and his complicated tragedies, his generosities, and his devotions, and I wrote those and left them out. Other people have written about him, and the ones who wrote about him and did not know him, I tried to help out on the parts about him that I knew, telling them of his great generosities and his kindnesses. But this is about the first part of Paris, and certain true aspects of it, and Scott did not know the early Paris that we knew, and loved, and worked in, and that always seemed different to me from anything that I have ever read about it. All of that Paris you could never put into a single book, and I have tried to write by the old rule that how good a book is should be judged, by the man who writes it, by the excellence of the material that he eliminates. So much that was interesting and instructive is gone, and this book is an attempt to distill rather than to amplify. André Masson and Miro are not there as they should be and will be, nor Gide teaching me how to punish a cat, nor how Evan Shipman and Harold Stearns ran through Evan's fortune when he came of age, but this is straight out of Dostoevsky. Nor did I mention up in the old Stade Anastasie on the Rue Pelleport, nor Menilmontant, where the fighters worked as waiters, and training Larry Gaines in all the great fights at the old Cirque d'Hiver and the Cirque de Paris, nor many of my best friends, Bill Bird, nor Mike Strader, nor the Black Forest, nor stories of Ezra and of Eliot and Belle Esprit, and the time Ezra left me the jar of opium for Cheever Dunning, nor the truth about Ford. I cut ruthlessly, and I hope it makes what is in stronger. I left out when it started with Pauline. That would have been a good way to end this book, except that it was a beginning, not an ending. Anyway, I wrote it and left it out. It is intact, and it starts another book. You can only write it in fiction, of course. It has the most happiness in it, and it is the saddest book I know. But it comes later. There is never any end to Paris, but maybe this will give you some true part of the people and places and the country when Hadley and I believed that we were invulnerable. But we were not invulnerable, and that was the end of the first part of Paris. Nobody climbs on skis now, and almost everybody breaks their legs. And maybe it is easier in the end to break your legs than to break your heart, although they say that everything breaks now and that, sometimes, many are stronger at the broken places. I do not know about that now, although I remember who said it. But this is how Paris and other places were in the early days when we were very poor and very happy. There is another book about the parts that are missing, and there are always the stories that were lost. So this is the end of it for now. There was never any end to Paris. But this is the end of the first basic part that always seemed different to me from anything that I had ever read about it. There is much more to write about Scott and his complicated tragedies, generosities, and devotions, and I wrote them and left them out. Other people have written them, and on the parts I knew, I tried to help them. This is about the first part of Paris, and Scott did not know the early Paris that we knew and loved and worked in. That Paris you could never put into a single book, and I have tried to write by the old rule that how good a book is should be judged by the man who writes it by the excellence of the material that he eliminates. The second part of Paris was wonderful, although it started tragically enough. That part, the part with Pauline, I have not eliminated, but have saved for the start of another book. It is a start, rather than an ending. It could be a good book because it tells many things that no one knows or can ever know, and it has love, remorse, contrition, and unbelievable happiness and final sorrow. That part, the part with Pauline, I have not eliminated, but have saved for the start of another book. It is called The Pilot Fish and the Rich, and Other Stories. There is no mention of Menilmontant, nor of the Stade Anastasie up the steep Rue Pelleport, where the boxers of the Anastasie stable served as waiters at the tables set out under the trees and the ring was in the garden, nor of training Larry Gaines, nor of the early days of Paulino, nor the great 20-round fights at the Cirque d'Hiver and the Cirque de Paris, nor things that only three of my best friends, Charlie Sweeney, Bill Bird, or Mike Strader knew. I left out most of the voyages, and I left out people that I loved or cared for deeply. And other people are not there as people are not there in life afterwards, although to themselves they are always more there than anyone. If, in your time, you have ever heard four honest people disagree about what happened at a certain place at a certain time, or you have ever torn up and returned orders that you requested when a situation had reached such a point that it seemed necessary to have something in writing, or testified before an inspector general when allegations had been made, presenting new statements by others that replaced your written orders and your verbal orders, you, remembering certain things and how they were to you and who had fought and where, you prefer to write about any time as fiction. There is never any ending to Paris, and the memory of each person who has lived in it differs from that of any other. We always return to it, no matter who we were, nor how it was changed, nor with what difficulties, nor what ease it could be reached. It was always worth it, and we received a return for whatever we brought to it.
A Movable Feast, the Restored Edition, was written by Ernest Hemingway and read by John Bedford Lloyd, with a foreword by Patrick Hemingway and an introduction by Sean Hemingway. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Amory Klimchak. A Movable Feast was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.